What you are about to experience will drive you mad.
We face a powerful enemy.
What is happening on this cube?
Something far worse is coming.
Do you believe in hell?
Neither did I until I saw it.
Unless we act quickly,
hell will come again.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton dipping his french fries in a peppermint shake, just like they do on the Riker and Troy farm.
That's right, and we're here this week to talk about the latest episode of Picard, Episode 8, Broken Pieces.
Yeah, Cam, I think for me, it feels as if they've kind of hit their stride when it comes to tone. In a show like this, like, I feel like also the supporting characters that don't have their name in the title of Star Trek Picard, I think we found the right balance with them. Like, they're actually becoming far more compelling in Broken Pieces to me. I engage with their journey. To me, I think you can make a very strong argument that, like, holistically speaking, this might be the strongest outing yet for Star Trek Picard.
I wildly disagree.
Really? Okay.
I think last week's is the strongest by far for me.
I said holistically speaking, though.
Okay.
So,
right.
And I think the moments on the Riker and Troy farm were great. The other stuff, not too bad. I think as like a whole episode, this is to me the most consistent. And they really are, like I keep using the word balance. They're striking the right balance here.
I appreciate that they finally have locked into the characters and the supporting characters, and they're playing well off of each other, but I just don't find them as interesting as this show thinks I should be finding them. That's, to me, the big problem. But I do agree, like, in terms of pacing and in terms of spending time with the characters, this was definitely a step up from some of the choppier, you know, everyone ignore the supporting cast while Picard goes on a mission episodes.
I think when we look back on this doing our rewatch, we're going to look at the mid-section of the season as more of those, like you say, kind of the choppy waters on this voyage.
Yeah.
Here,
yeah,
I think they're, you know, with last week's episode, which was great, this one I thought was great as well. I hope that we're going into the two-part season finale that they've really kind of hit their stride here. And this episode, Broken Pieces, we get the return of Seven of Nine. I think she's getting better stuff to do than in the Stardust City stuff, where she becomes a first-degree murderer.
Is it hard, though? Is it hard to give Seven better stuff than that?
Jerry Ryan on screen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look, make her read the phone book.
Sure.
So,
sure.
Yeah. We're also getting into kind of depth on, like, what is making Rios tick. I have to say, the mystery box, the puzzle box sort of elements that you see so much in television nowadays,
yeah,
I'm getting less patient with it.
Yeah.
And ultimately, I think if you told us the stuff off the bat with Rios' character, I would have been far more invested in this character earlier on. And the other thing is, does the mystery ultimately pay off? It's like he had a very traumatic experience with a captain, and it all has to do with synths, blah, blah, blah. It's like they want us to be like far more invested in this mystery, where I'm far more invested in just kind of spending time with this crew, though.
I enjoyed the fact that the episode was giving us moments with Raffi, a character who I think maybe had a little bit of a bumpier trajectory in getting that character kind of grounded on the series. But I do like that they're giving her little character moments here or there. But you are right. Like, I was not a fan of the multiplicity approach to trying to understand the psyche of Rios.
Oh, I actually like that sequence a lot.
I did not like that scene at all.
I did. Okay.
But I thought it was like comedically dead. I just did not enjoy watching that scene.
I don't know. I wasn't really laughing or anything like that. But did you think that they were going for laughs? Or?
Well, I think there's definitely going for comedic arch value with the various holodeck characters, for sure. But I just did not find that sequence, for me, interesting.
Like,
are you
talking about, like, Raffi going back and forth with the five holograms in Picard's chateau?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. That totally worked for me. I'm actually finding, like, Santiago Cabrera, like, it was actually fun to watch him just as a performer in this episode.
He gets a lot to do.
Six different characters to play. This sequence worked for me, though. You see them bouncing back and forth. What doesn't work for me, though, is Ian's accent as the engineer with the Scottish accent. That was kind of skin crawling to listen to. It sounded like you trying to do a Scottish accent, Cam.
I'm not even going to try.
No.
I just find with those holodeck characters, a little goes a long way for me personally. I don't know how everyone else feels, but for me personally, I find them very nails on the chalkboard. And so now I've got five of them in a scene that is dragging information out of, you know, a character that would be, I think, far more interestingly delivered talking to that actual character. So that was my issue with it.
Just to jump on one point, though, bring up the Raffi thing.
Yeah.
I wrote in my notes, though, it's like fun Raffi equals the best Raffi. And I think, this episode is emphasizing to me, like, they are kind of hitting their stride with the characters and, like, they're making Raffi work in a way. And it's not by making her, you know, like, full of pathos with you know, doing her drinking and her drugs and all that.
Right.
It's her kind of bouncing off different characters within scenes, her kind of doing goofy faces or intonations in her voice when she's reacting to things.
Yeah.
That to me is kind of the character that I have fun watching. And I think they really are doing that well, especially in these last two episodes here.
No, totally agree. I really enjoy her little character moments. I love when she's trying to get the wine out of the replicator, and she's programmed it to not give it to her, and then she's also overridden that. As in, like, don't let me override this.
Well, yeah, when we're in Las Vegas, Cam, at the big Star Trek convention, you're my replicator lock at a certain point of all-night drinking with the Star Trek actors. So,
but I did feel like it's almost like they didn't know what to do with this character in this episode. So like, okay, well, we've got to resolve Rios's backstory. So what if this Raffi has to spend the whole episode trying to figure out Rios's backstory?
You say that you don't think that they knew what to do with the character. I think they knew exactly what to do with the character. Like, what is her job? What was her job back in Starfleet?
I don't know. What was her job?
Oh, she was working security there.
Like, right, yeah.
And again, she's on the case. She's doing detective work. It's showing her utilitarian facets here. I think that they knew exactly what they were doing with this character.
But it's not interesting, at least for me personally, to watch a character just go through all these endless investigative techniques to get a character to sit down on the floor and tell them their backstory.
But, you know, like, would she have been able to pull that out of him without doing so either?
I mean, maybe not. I don't know. I really don't know. But, I mean, I think of, like, the better episodes.
Well, I mean, the answer is, well, the writers could write whatever they wanted.
That's true.
You know, and I think it's far more interesting if you have a character like Raffi, you know, showcasing what she can do and be as a character. That's a far more interesting thing than her just walking right into the room and, like, just talking to him right away, though, you know? I think maybe, I don't want to speak for you, but maybe the more grating stuff for me on a narrative level is kind of the whole mystery box element.
Yeah, no, I agree.
It's just like, to me, I don't think it's necessary. And I think, I heard a great interview with the president of AMC last week. This is on the Watch podcast. And she was saying that how oftentimes writers nowadays mistake darkness for sophistication.
Yeah.
And I get a lot of sense in that sometimes in Star Trek Picard. And I also get the sense that they mistake puzzle boxes, mystery boxes for sophistication as well.
Yeah.
Do you know what I think the more challenging thing to do as a writer? Don't work within those parameters. You're going to be far more challenged if you have, like, hopeful, optimistic characters that you're dealing with and trying to create conflict within them. I've been thinking about this a lot lately, like, just about, like, growing up watching TNG and hearing some interviews from the writers saying, like, it was very difficult to write for that show because characters weren't allowed to have internal conflict.
Yep.
Brandon Braga, though, has spoken in the past about how, well, you know, being challenged as a writer isn't necessarily a bad thing. I have a lot more appreciation for what they're accomplishing in TNG under those constraints than when we watch Discovery, we watch Picard, and there's no such constraints.
Right.
That doesn't seem nearly as challenging to do. Anybody can, like, drop an F-bomb into a scene, you know, anybody can, you know, start, you know, boozing, drinking just to show how dark they are.
Right.
This to me is why I'm kind of happy if we are seeing the characters, again, I use that word balance, but they don't have to come with all this baggage that they seem to be straddled with at the beginning of the season. And they seem to have, like, a mission that they all believe in. This is what I'm really liking about this episode, though, is everybody's on board with each other. As Agnes says, you're the first time that I've had a crew.
Mm-hmm.
I like this, though. This is why I'm really drawn into this episode. But for you, it just seems, is it just not working, this episode not working for you from a narrative standpoint, I think for you, there's more of an arching thing where this episode kind of stumbled more than it succeeded.
Elements do work in this episode for me. Like, it's not to me, a wash through. Like, there's, I do enjoy that they get more out of the Rafi character. And there's some other interactions in this episode I did genuinely enjoy. But just talking about the Rio stuff that we're beginning with, I just find, like, this show is not grabbing me with a lot of its character stuff. And I think a lot of it is so bogged down with story elements that
I'm not going to disagree with you there.
Yeah. And I guess it just depends, because I see people online who are loving the story. Like, they are, like, really drawn into this whole Borg mystery and the Romulan stuff. Great. And I think there's elements of it that really work. But for me, it's just falling really flat in an energy way. Like, even Discovery,
I'm not disagreeing with you that, like, I've had those similar issues as well.
Yeah.
You know, but I've seen maybe in the last two episodes, it is starting to, again, kind of hit the mark in a way that I think they were missing it throughout a lot of the earlier episodes.
Well, it feels more confident these last two, for sure.
And I think a lot of it has to do with maybe a lightening of the mood.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's why I said, like, maybe the things that we like most about Discovery are those lighter moments. I'm liking the lighter stuff on Star Trek Picard as well. We got a lot of that in episode 7. We're getting a lot of that now in Broken Pieces. So that's why it's kind of working for me. I think what you're saying overall, though, I'm not disagreeing with you on, like, kind of the broader sense. Mm-hmm. For me, I think just more of this episode works for me than I think works for you.
But getting back to that mystery box element, think of the episodes where Troy was written really well in an episode doing counseling. There's not a lot of them. TNG, you know, the writers will attest to that. They did not know how to write Troy a lot of the time. But when she had those moments, even last week, you know, where she's talking to people, you feel like you're coming to an organic moment, and a moment of organic realization. And I felt like that's missing in this whole thing with Rios, who's locked himself in a room purposely to remove himself from, like, the entire story, which I find very frustrating, because that's all we're doing. We're basically wasting time so that Rafi can get into the room to talk to him. So it's like, okay.
So that maybe it lines up with the time that Soji is there and he opens up the drawing and they connect all the dots. I know what you're saying about, like, the feeling of having it more organic, because I get a lot of sense that maybe the writers all met up, broke this overarching story into, you know, 10 pieces, and then they kind of reverse engineered where they're going to start, and then they need to say, like, well, you need to hit this story beat, this story beat, this story beat in any given episode. And I think that does it's not great for that organic storytelling that you just mentioned.
Right. Another issue, and I don't know, I guess I'll have to determine going forward how I feel about it, but we find out in this episode that, you know, the source of Rios' trauma that we finally unlock is that he encountered an android just like Soji, that, you know, the execution of that android and then the suicide of his captain really has tormented him. Does this create kind of a small universe problem where it's like the character that they, you know, we're tracking down the whole time is the same one, basically, you know, a replica of the one that instilled the, you know, psychic damage in a character who was not connected to any of this stuff when they went to find him, you know, in episode 3.
It didn't bother me. It didn't faze me until you brought it up. And now I'm just like, oh, yeah, that it is a little silly. I guess if you want to reverse engineer it, the link through Rios on the show, though, is through Rafi, who is the one who is spearheading this investigation into this synth conspiracy. So maybe, I don't know. I think it's getting really convoluted if we're trying to make excuses here, but it gets a little silly.
It's kind of that Star Wars problem where they would constantly write classic Star Wars characters into situations where they were dealing with prequel characters or sequel trilogy characters, where suddenly it's like, wait, this is like an expansive universe. Why are all these people constantly bumping into one another?
Although, watch Deep Space Nine.
Oh, yeah.
No,
Deep Space 12, Tyler.
I love that moment where, like, Rios was just like, yeah, the closest station is Deep Space 12. And I was just like, oh, man.
With Captain Ken Briscoe.
Ken Briscoe.
Yeah. You got Ben Sisko on Deep Space Nine and Ken Briscoe on Deep Space 12.
I was thinking of Kent Brockman from The Simpsons. Right. I was just like, wow. Okay.
With the ant overlords.
Yes, yes. I can move past, like, an element like that. I'm not going to get too hung up on this. For me, some of the other character stuff, this is why I am pointing to the kind of the characters, the supporting characters getting better stuff to do there. I like Agnes Girardi having that moment to look at a creation like Soji and appreciates this majesty She was calling it artwork. You could tell by her performance there that she's just in complete awe of this realization, like her career-long dream that's she could never realize because of the synth ban. You know, like that's me. And Soji trying to like get more information out of Girardi about what it means to be synthetic. You know, like I thought that was a great sequence between those two characters that have not necessarily been well served throughout much of the series.
I thought the best written scenes in the episode were two Soji scenes, which is that one and the one where she's talking to Picard about Data.
Yeah, that was interesting. And I'm mostly going to give props to Patrick Stewart, though, because, right. You know, when it's funny, she was like, so how would you describe Data? Dude, the first word that came to my head was curious. And that was actually the second word that Picard used to describe him. He called him brave, curious. I was a little bit miffed with his description of kind of love, you know, because Picard never said, I loved him.
Yeah.
Soji said, did you love him? He's like, yeah, in my own way.
What would you have said before even Star Trek Picard? Would you have said Picard loved Data?
No.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way.
So, yeah.
I think he had, like, the utmost respect for him. But I always felt like, I don't know, maybe he did come to love him. Especially after he sat down and played cards with them all in All Good Things. Yeah, but Picard was always a guy who I always felt like had a certain amount of professional distance. And a respectful professional distance, not like a, you know, jerk boss type, but like, I don't know that he would really say he loved him. That's the thing.
I get that.
But it was like, you know, a student or like a protege he was really had invested a lot into, but there is like kind of a little bit of that almost emotional distance because he has to have that to be the mentor he needs to be.
Yeah, especially if you know that Geordi LaForge is shrugging his shoulders when Data's running to his death.
And that man loved Data.
And that man loved Data, yeah. The other thing that she asked, though, is like, did Data love you, Picard?
Yeah.
And then Picard was like, well, he didn't have the capacity to do that. But remember Star Trek Generations when he gets an emotion chip?
Yeah.
And then remember in Star Trek First Contact where he turns the chip off?
Yeah.
They're just kind of forgetting the fact that this man, this android, did have emotions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't think they like to think back on the emotion chip too much.
Nah.
I feel like that little experiment, you know, it got them a couple wacky things in those movies, but I don't think that's something you're going to see a lot of future Star Trek reflect back on.
Well, I don't know. You still do the Mr. Tricorder puppeteering all the time,
which is
quite grating.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I want to ask you this, though. The central question about, like, sentience that is kind of driving Soji's journey, her own existential crisis right now, though.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a question that I wonder about when it comes to my own conception of these sorts of stories, TV shows, movies. You know, think about something like Ex Machina, for example.
Right.
So for me, I look at a character like Data, and I'm just like, yes, he's sentient. I care about him as a character. I'm invested in his journey. I wonder how much of that has to do and is tied into the performance of Brent Spiner.
Yeah.
And I watched the Soji character, and I'm not having those same connections with it. And I don't know if it's because of Briones's performance versus just Spiner's performance. But if you ask me, you know, are robots real? Are robots really sentient? My answer right now in 2020 is like, no.
Yeah.
Like I like AI, artificial intelligence. I am an organic sentient being. I believe that I am superior to an AI robot. Like,
right.
And so when you're asking me to be invested in this kind of journey, I don't know how much I care about what Soji's ultimate goal is. And I know that makes me sound callous to many Star Trek fans, but it is posing problems for me being completely invested in the end game for this show.
No, I kind of know exactly what you mean. And I wonder how much of it is a Uncanny Valley problem. Whereas when we look at Data, when we look at Arium even, they are characters who seem...
Well, I wouldn't use Arium as an example.
Arium is a cyborg, but there is like a difference. I mean, when you look at that character, the character you're seeing looks robotic, but you're investing like an emotion and you almost like want to see them become more like everyone else, right? And when you look at Soji, the actress looks like a human. So you don't have that same distance in a visual that you have with other outsider characters.
Yeah.
Even Seven of Nine.
I know what you're saying.
Whereas we look at, you know, Issa Briones, and we're like, that looks as human as every other character on the show. I mean, they may have given her a little bit of like a CG polish just to look a little bit, because I noticed like Alison Pill just looks a little more human on screen than say like than Soji does.
Well, in all fairness, when they are going back and forth, she's been in a coma the past couple days. I think they are doing purpose makeup jobs on her. And I wouldn't say there's like CG being applied to Issa Briones at all. If anything, probably like makeup.
Yeah, possibly just makeup, but it's more subtle. It's so subtle that it looks human, and I think that's maybe the issue, because we don't have that sort of that underdog sense with her that we had with your Datas or your Sevens or whatever.
Yeah.
And I just wonder if that's a certain element that is missing from that character. I don't think people dislike this character at all. I haven't been seeing people complain about Soji as a character, but I do wonder if there's a certain there's a certain power lost when the character looks too human.
And I don't dislike the character. I just don't know if I care about the character all that much.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I care about her journey that much as well. And also, I didn't miss the fact that Narek was not in this episode whatsoever. Another character that I just don't really care about.
Have they given us enough with Soji for us to care? Because, like, you know, you look at Data. I think his arc, you know, is set up very well in the first episode of TNG, a episode that doesn't set up a lot of things well, but it does Data very well. And then we spend a lot of time with Data on this journey. Whereas, like, Soji, we got, like, what, 3 episodes or 4 episodes or whatever with Narek. And then, you know, we've gotten the last episode. We got this episode. That's not a lot.
How much did you care about Data by episode 8 of Star Trek The Next Generation? Season 1, episode 8. Was that up the long ladder territory?
That's season 2.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know what I feel like that might be the one with like the old admiral or something who's gone evil.
Sure.
And is like getting younger or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But he
looks very 80s when he's young, which is hilarious to me.
I will say this. Data in the first handful of episodes of TNG, even not great episodes like The Naked Now, you are getting some iconic moments with Data that people still remember and still talk about.
Fully functional.
That's right. Yeah. And I think Data lore was in the first 8,
I think it was maybe the episode 12.
Was it that far down?
If I remember correctly. Yeah.
But I do feel like you did have enough Data moments to really latch onto, and there was an idiosyncratic quality to that character that, again, it does not exist in Soji.
Well, the other thing is, what we don't have on Star Trek Picard that's typical of other Star Trek series is that go-to outsider character, the one that they just, you know, cake in tons of alien makeup, you know? Yeah. Who's the most alien-looking character? Like Elnor? And Narek in the main cast.
Yeah.
You know, they've got funny ears, you know.
Yeah, and Elnor is in a lot of ways in the perfect spot to be an outsider character, but the show has made him an outsider by removing him from the cast entirely.
Yeah, we'll get into that
we'll get to him later.
In just a moment, because it's tough if all you're giving your main character to do are action sequences.
Yeah.
It's still tough for me to get super invested to that character there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do want to address the mythology of this series. And again, we go back to the puzzle box stuff. And are you getting the sense that this whole, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago, people made a warning about synthetic beings and they kept saying crossing the threshold.
That's right. And salamander babies.
Well, the thing is, you joke about it. I think that they are doing like a nod to Voyager with that, because as soon as Picard says threshold for, I think, the 14th time, we do have Rios reference Zephyrim and warp drive.
Yes.
And again, that makes me think of warp 10 and this evolution that you're going towards. And I wonder, like, you've got like the Borg cube featured in 7 out of 8 episodes here.
No, 7 out of 9.
Thank you, Eric. Yeah. People have been speculating about this, but do you think that they're really telegraphing the fact that this is essentially kind of the Borg origin story that they're getting at here? Or do you think it's still up for grabs what this could ultimately be about?
I mean, I think everyone has always wanted a Borg origin story, and so much has been written in fan fiction and novels about trying to tie it to, say, like V'ger and things like that. Like, I think people want those answers for the Borg. And I do wonder, we think about the series Voyager, and then all the TNG episodes, and we did an episode on the evolution of Borg, and the Borg have felt so exhausted in terms of continuing to try to get something out of them by revisiting them over and over.
They're not ominous anymore.
Right. Is there anything left to do but to delve into that origin story and just give us that? Yeah. Because at least that might, if written really well, be interesting. Not that prequels are ever a really safe way to go for storytelling, but it's an avenue we haven't seen. I'll say that much. So it's possible.
Possible. That's possible. That's the word of a coward.
It would not surprise me at all if that's what they're going to go for.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think it's likely or unlikely that that's what they're aiming for?
Well, okay, the way I look at it is there a reason to have the Borg on this show if you don't do that? And I don't know that really.
Because,
Picard,
why else are the Borg here?
Yeah, exactly. It's a lot about Romulans, and we've delved into, obviously, all the synth stuff. But when it comes to the Borg, that hasn't really been touched on that closely as to why the Romulans are so invested in, like, a Borg cube.
You kind of wonder, like, could they not have all the so generic stuff on a different alien sort of artifact? Like, why the Borg? Have they justified that yet?
I don't think so. And it would be a far less busy narrative, you know, for 10 episodes if you didn't have the Borg.
Yeah.
Like, if you removed all that mythology, you could actually have a much cleaner story. So, like, I feel like, yeah, I am going to say, yeah, it is very likely we are going to do some sort of Borg origin, because why else are they here?
Yeah. Let's get into the Seven of Nine stuff. She makes a glorious shootout of a return, once again, using violence to get to whatever she has to accomplish here.
Yeah.
Ultimately, we get kind of a mini collective here with her being... I know people are going to be out there saying she's the new Borg queen. I think they're going for something completely distinct from that, though. You know, like, she's speaking with the voice of the Borg. And I do like how the collective references her as, you know, Annika still has more work to do.
Right.
I love it when they're using her, like, given name, you know. We didn't really touch on that in episode 5 when she appeared in Stardust City Reg. So, I like she's getting Elnor to bounce off of. I wish they were giving Elnor better stuff to do than just, like, slice people's heads open. You know? It's kind of like...
No. Violence is wrong, Tyler, and you never do it.
I've learned that lesson, thank you, at this point. You know?
They have that moment that we have here, like, Jerry Ryan triumphantly gunning down, like, Romulans.
I think one of the things that I complained about with Star Trek Beyond was just how capricious it was with the death of, like, half the crew during the destruction of the Enterprise.
Right.
I don't like the capricious nature of a lot of the violence going on here. And look, I don't have, like, a super weak stomach, you know, but it's just, like, there's something that it seems so easygoing about the violence that bothers me.
Well, I mean, I have a very strong stomach for violence, and to me, it's just it feels like a little dumbed down. You know, there's always been those complaints. Star Trek's boring, it says non-fans, and they're like, no, Star Trek's badass. Yeah. Look at this double phaser rifles.
But to me, I kind of get bored during those sequences.
Oh, they're not well directed. One was not particularly well shot. Like, it was not like a great action sequence or anything.
But for me, it's just like, okay, I watching people get shot.
Yeah.
It's like, I get it. Like, more people getting shot. I get it.
Well, you and I have seen how many action movies where people have, like, you know, two guns or something. And you can really tell the ones that are well directed versus the ones that are very just pedestrian and really just there to grab people who maybe don't really... you know, think about the aesthetics of shooting these types of sequences.
But what was well directed in this stuff is, like, let's look at the Jurati and Soji scene.
That's
stuff that the director's interested in. There was a good conversation going on about, you and I, we both listened to the Big Picture Show podcast as well.
Yep.
And they were talking about best director nominees in the Oscars and how there's a certain masculinity associated with it. As if you do kind of the show-offy... athleticism is the term that they kept using. They're using 1917 as an example of that. But if you do, you know, these very showy action sequences, you're going to have a more likely chance of being recognized as opposed to if you're the director who's really good with working with actors, bringing out performances with them. So I think, you know, again, I'm forgetting the director's name, but again, it was a woman director. And so it's just kind of like, okay, we can critique this for not being like a great action event, but I mean, is that ultimately the goal of this episode? I mean, they're trying to make it exciting.
I would argue, though, that if you want to have this moment where Seven does come in, you know, the cavalry to save the day, you want it to be an impact moment. And I don't think this really worked as that. Yeah. So I would say it didn't succeed in that regard. But that's also not why I watch Star Trek.
Exactly.
So at the same time, I don't care.
Well, and that's for me. It's just like I watched this, didn't care. But yeah. It wasn't like it was important for me that to get a good action sequence.
No.
What I did appreciate, though, is Rizzo is her disruptor eventually starts like malfunctioning because she's shooting so many people.
Yeah.
We've never really seen that in Star Trek before.
No.
Like that was actually kind of a fun sequence.
I mean, they've definitely done a far better job at building Rizzo into a villain who I'm not going to say is multidimensional, but is at least memorable than Narek.
I think they're really kind of regretting that it's Narek that they put in the main cast rather than Rizzo.
What was going on?
They're writing the show. You know, they're a couple episodes in. They're like, we need to lock down our main cast. So yeah, this is going to be a main character. I think they didn't know what they had with Rizzo. They didn't. Mm-hmm. They probably didn't know how much she was going to be given, and they probably didn't realize, you know, like maybe this Narek stuff with him being the toxic boyfriend wasn't at all that interesting in the first place.
Right.
And so they're kind of stuck with it. He was gone the entire episode.
No, Tyler, he was there in that CG ship at the end.
There you go. His name actually wasn't in the episode.
I know. Yeah.
So, did you miss him?
No.
Yeah.
No, I think Rizzo is just a far more interesting character and has just more screen presence.
Same with O. Like, when we saw O in yet again the eighth consecutive flashback to kick off the episode, I was like, great, O's back. Like, I like O. I like Rizzo. It's just kind of like, don't need to see Narek ever again.
I mean, you know, we can complain about maybe Star Trek Picard going for the darkness or the easy violence, but I did think it was an effective opening sequence where you had all these, you know, applicants doing the admonition?
Admonition.
Yeah. And like grabbing this, I don't know, energy beam. And then the ones losing their minds. Like, I thought that was a pretty effective horror sequence.
And, you know, I want to go into that sequence because I think it's very important.
Mm-hmm.
I also will make the argument that they should have had this sequence, like, in episode 3.
I agree.
So that we know what the villain's goals are. We understand what their motivation is.
Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is the antagonists here, they believe 100% that they have a righteous cause that they are trying to pursue here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, I'd be far more interested in the villain's, you know, journey if I'd known that from the very outset. And I think the way that they actually showcased it, you and I complained a lot about the violence in Stardust City Reg.
Yeah.
This was a violent sequence, but it wasn't like they're trying to make it like torture porn or anything like that, you know? And I think the violence here is important because we understand the horrors that they've been exposed to and why they are feeling so determined to stop the destroyer, whatever it may be.
And also the will of those like Rizzo, who managed to survive it.
Didn't Rizzo look super badass? And you're like, oh, this is why we're following this character this entire time. Like she has, as you say, a certain amount of will that I just don't know if Narek possesses.
Well, I understand the cracks in Rizzo's, you know, psyche now going forward. Whereas with Narek, I don't. And I mean, it's not like they're writing Rizzo as this like really, really like multi-dimensional villain. But a sequence like this gives me something to read into the character and to apply to her scenes in this episode and going forward that I don't have with Narek.
Yeah. Let's be honest. It was fun to see those drones swarm over her.
Oh,
and
yeah. It was awesome.
That's a cool thing to see happen to like kind of an antagonist who's been like murdering like fan favorite characters like Hugh, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
And did you notice when Seven of Nine enters the ship, she makes her grand entrance. She says, "Where's Hugh?"
Yeah.
I get the sense that these are two characters that obviously knew and interacted with each other as former Borg drones, mm-hmm. whereas Seven of Nine and Picard didn't meet until just a few, you know, days ago. I think we missed getting a scene between Hugh and Seven at one point in the series. And I know you can only get Jeri Ryan for so many episodes, although I guess this is technically her third episode and looks like she's going to be in at least the next one too.
They've got to have her in probably the two at the end, right? It would seem weird to not have her in the finale.
Well, it's a two-part finale.
Yeah.
So they'll have her at least I think at the very least one of those parts. So
just dropping off Elnor at the start of the next episode, like, see you later, Elnor.
And that's the last we ever see of Seven of Nine in all of Star Trek.
Yeah. Sure. So she's getting a spinoff, isn't she?
Look, they'd be kind of dumb not to give her a spinoff at this point. Like, it just makes financial sense. You and I are, I think, a little bit more down on her episode 5 appearance than a lot of fans. But the thing is, like, I'm still excited to see her on screen whenever she's returning. I think it'd be CBS's loss if they don't pursue this.
I mean, they created this whole Fenris Rangers thing,
I know. Yeah.
But given us nothing about them, really. So you could totally do a spinoff with her in the Fenris Rangers, where we actually learn about that world and the characters who inhabit it and all that sort of stuff.
How interested do you think Jeri Ryan is? She's early 50s at this point, I think maybe just 51. She's had her time away from Star Trek. She's had like almost two decades away from Star Trek. She's carved out her own identity as an actress, and she's been working nonstop. She's been very, very successful. I don't think it's out of the question that she'd be like, yeah, you know what? I'd be willing to go ahead and be the star of a show that I know will be guaranteed for at least a couple seasons.
Yeah.
People will continue to adore me. I get to work with a character, do very different things with this character than I did, you know, 20, 25 years ago.
Don't have to wear the like onesie. Yeah.
I will, just in support of her. Yeah. So.
And also, I mean, also acknowledge, like, you know, Jeri Ryan at her age, like, you're less likely to get hired as an actress to be the lead of a show.
Yeah, yeah.
And she would be the lead, number one on the call sheet. And I do think
that's one, Jonathan Frakes.
Oh, of course.
Number one. Yeah.
But I do think that might be appealing. It just depends, I guess, where her life's at right now. If she feels like being locked down for that sort of duty, because that is going to be more commitment than doing, you know, a few guest starring roles on a TV show for a while or hopping around.
I think actors want to work.
I think so too.
I think actors want to know that they're wanted, you know? So I'd be willing to say that she'd be willing to lock herself down for, you know, I think a lot of these shows, I'd be surprised if Picard goes on for more than three seasons. I think Discovery, I'd be surprised if it goes on for more than five seasons. Mm-hmm. Just in the streaming reality, you look at like shows on Netflix, they typically only run three or four seasons. And the reason why is you can kind of figure out the math. Like most viewers, they only have the attention span for about three or four seasons. Yeah. And I think Netflix has figured that out. And that's why these streaming shows, there's a very finite time limit. And I think that probably works well with maybe Jeri Ryan's own, you know, personal, you know, interest in doing this.
Also, Jeri Ryan was on Voyager for 4 years. That show was running 26 episodes a season. It was like backbreaking, grueling work to do a Star Trek show in those days. That's not the same case when she's going to do this show or doing her own spinoff. Like the hour's going to be very different, 10 episodes or something. A lot more can be done with CG versus practical, which means probably less time on a set for her. I think it's probably just a more appealing prospect to commit yourself to now.
Yeah, every scene it's going to be on a blue screen, and they'll just CG characters in for her to be talking to. You know, she's just going to be talking to golf balls the entire time.
She can shoot it in her living room.
She'll do an hour a day and be like, "See you later, suckas." So, okay, maybe we can resurrect Icheb as well for this somehow.
So, what did you think of this moment of her plugging into the cube and awakening the drones?
I liked it. I was excited to watch it go down. You have a look in your eye that says it was stupid, but I...
No. I don't think it was stupid. No.
I thought it was cool.
I thought it was really a fun idea to have her regenerate the cube. I do wonder if, like, the buildup matched the payoff. Because, like, when she's plugging in, you're like, oh my god, this is going to be incredible. And when it was all said and done, I was like, well, you know, it was okay.
Well, do you think that's because of what ultimately happens to those drones that are just like blown out of the airlocks?
Yeah, I do think so. I mean, it is playing with your expectations, I guess, because you are expecting this unstoppable army or something, but and then they're quickly all blown out the airlock. But
is that it? Like that kind of confused me. It's like, as you say, there's all this buildup.
Yeah.
And then they're quickly pushed out the airlock.
Yeah.
And we have all these Romulan ships that are outside. It's not like they're being attacked by drones in space.
Yeah.
So I don't... I don't know. Like, I'd be kind of bummed out if they don't play a part in one of the next episodes.
I would hope they would. I
just don't know how, you know? No, we have seen in Star Trek First Contact that it's not like they need an atmosphere to survive or anything.
Right.
So, you know? And it looks as if this mini collective is still going at it just in terms of them, you know, swarming Rizzo. So...
Yeah?
I'm not out of the question that the drones float on back home.
I feel like you don't regenerate a cube if you're not going to use it.
Yeah.
You know, I think we will probably get a little bit more with that Borg cube. Those sets, man, they cost money.
Well, is that the spinoff? Just 7 of 9 and Elnor? Like,
oh, no.
They just go and blast into locations every week and, you know.
Yeah. And it's all just set on the Borg cube. Maybe it's other characters just coming to the Borg cube every week.
Yeah, that's why she can be behind that blue screen the entire, or in front of the blue screen the entire time, because it's just a Borg cube action.
It's like Jeri throwing those black contacts again.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do feel like, the Elnor stuff, I don't know that they've yet established why this character needed to stay behind in an interesting way.
I think it's to the detriment of the character and the detriment of the story. You know, and it may be they were on their blackboards. Do people still use blackboards? Probably a whiteboard in this case.
Yeah, I would think whiteboard.
And they're breaking down the story. And I bet there's a sequence at the very end that they want Elnor to be part of. And a lot of that had to do with the Borg cube.
Yeah.
I just don't think it's been worth it the last two episodes. It has seemed kind of lame and boring. This is a character that I like. I just don't think they've given him like great material. Like we talked about before. It's just like this Saru issue. It's just like it seems as if it's just floating there. You just need to give him something, and they really haven't been doing that since his appearance in episode 4.
Do you even think of him as a main character on the show?
Again, why is he in the main credits?
Yeah,
it's kind of weird.
Yeah, I mean, like he was more compelling, and he wasn't in the main credits.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, exactly.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah, it's only like two episodes, obviously, but nonetheless.
Yeah, I don't know. I think this is why, like, we're talking about kind of that organic storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I kind of get the sense it's like they're probably reverse engineering like a lot of things that they want to do with the characters. And I think like don't be so hung up on where episode 10 is supposed to end off.
Yeah.
Like I think it would have been interesting if you started Picard, you know, from episode 1 and then found a compelling journey for him to go on from there.
Yeah.
And I wonder when we get to the very end of the season, we're going to be asking ourselves – was it to the detriment of the writers to conceive of this story as, and they keep using the phrase, a 10-hour movie?
Yeah.
Versus just finding individual stories to tell with these characters where you just put the serialized story in the background.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wonder if we've gotten enough compelling stories out of these characters because they want to tell more of an overarching sort of story, though.
Yeah. No, it's very true. And when I see this moment at the end with all these Romulan ships firing off in pursuit of our heroes, it's hard not to think that we're going to have, you know, Seven leading the Borg in as the last-minute saviors.
Yeah.
Which we watched the finale of Star Trek Discovery Season 2, which was a big battle, and it was great.
Yeah.
Like, it really, really delivered. But I'm hoping that they aren't taking that as like this is how we need to end our seasons. Like, we need to have the big battles at the end. And I hope that they'll be smart. Do something like Doctor Strange did, where set us up for what we think we're going to get, and then do something that's even better and totally outside of our expectations. You know, in that movie, it was setting up this big conflict with, the big villain Caecilius. And then it turns out it's like, you know, Doctor Strange facing off against Dormammu and then having to outsmart him by dying over and over again. Like, that's not what we ever thought we would get.
I like when Star Trek characters get to be smart. That's what drew me to the show, you know? So
yeah.
I'm much more appreciative of that than I am of, like, just, like, dogfights in outer space.
Mm-hmm. When you do say, like, a 10-hour movie, you know, the movie has a big climax usually, and that's what this makes me think of.
But even in, like, big action movies nowadays, like I think about all the Marvel stuff, I get so bored watching those big climaxes, you know. Like that's been a criticism of a lot of these Marvel movies, is like you got a lot of, like, you know, maybe the first two acts are great and then it's just people punching each other nonstop for like 40 minutes, and I'm just kind of like, okay, like how long until we get to the end? That's why I like the Doctor Strange like climax, like that was great there.
Yeah, I do think, though, if you work in character moments into the action sequences, that can work better. And that's something that Marvel has actually been, I think, fairly good at. Whereas I look at, say, like some of the DC ones with big battles at the end, those are the ones that really bore me.
They both bore me, but the DC ones bore me far more than the Marvel ones.
Yeah.
You know, I would say the second time I watched Endgame, actually, maybe even the first time as well, the big climax there, it was paced very well.
It's not very long either.
And I think that's like a good thing, though. It's just like and maybe it's just because like they're already looking at like a 3-hour movie and they're like, do we really need to just like have people like punching each other really hard for like another 45 minutes? You know, I'm okay if you do like a 15-minute action sequence to cap off your movie.
Yeah.
That's fine. You know, so I want to talk to you about the stakes, and that's something that we had discussions with Star Trek Discovery, and again,
both seasons,
and with this, we start off the stakes as Picard believing that he needs to go and save the daughter of one of his dearest friends. I can buy into those stakes. They're smaller in scale. I'm fine with that. You look at some of the strongest episodes of Star Trek. Think of something like The Drumhead.
Yeah.
The stakes there, it was a man's career. It was a man's reputation. that to me, I was so sucked into that. Mm-hmm. But again, by last week's episodes, we're told that the stakes are the survival of the universe, apparently.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just like if every, and we saw that both seasons with Star Trek Discovery, if every single time it's about the survival of the universe, I'm just like, well, I guess I know what's going to happen. Our characters succeed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like to me, I, like then the stakes mean nothing at this point. And it's just like, they haven't really learned that this Kurtzman era crew of writers, I'm surprised that that hasn't really occurred to them at this point.
It does seem weird to what seems like repeat yourself three times in a row. Like, I don't really know how that happens.
Yeah.
Because
laziness.
It's so weird, though, because, you know, Kurtzman was involved heavily with the first two JJ Star Treks. It's not like they repeated themselves, like, twice in a row.
Yeah.
They did with maybe a couple of the action sequences. But, you know, in terms of their overall plotting, it's not like they kept going back to the same exact place. So I don't know why he would, what it looks like, do that three times in a row, where once again the fate of the galaxy is, you know, going to be, I guess, you know, everything's going to go Armageddon, basically.
Yeah. Although, if you look at all the Star Trek movies, the stakes always seem to be the destruction of Earth.
That's true.
Which, that got very repetitive.
Fair enough, you know? Yeah.
But look at a great one like Star Trek VI. Mm-hmm. The stakes there are peace in the galaxy. You know? And the thing is, I'm kind of invested in that. I don't think if, you know, Kirk fails in uncovering this cabal, then that means the galaxy is literally going to implode. But the fact is, like, we have a stable political order, which I think taps into a lot of the anxieties at the time when you have the dissolution of the USSR going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, to me, that's something that we can buy into, and it still pays off watching it, like, 30 years later.
Or even Best of Both Worlds, where you have the Borg threat, but it's really about how do we get Picard back.
Exactly. Like, you're invested in that man's future, you know?
Yeah.
So...
And that's tied to, like, even the big slam-bang Voyager two-parters as well, which are some of them really fantastic. It's very simple stakes that we can understand.
And that's, I think, going to be the problem with, like, season two of Star Trek Picard. Like, what are the stakes going to be? If you start season one with, like, the entire fate of the galaxy depends on this.
Yeah.
Well, then what are you going to do in season two? You know?
Right, where, yeah, I mean... I guess at this point, the Romulans think it's going to be like Armageddon, so maybe it's undercut in the sense it isn't. Like, they're wrong, which is a little bit of a reversal on that. But nonetheless, it's Picard potentially saving the life and the freedoms of all synths everywhere, potentially. And it's like, okay, so what's he doing for season two?
Yeah, that's when Q comes, man.
I guess. It
sends him back to Sherwood Forest.
What made, like, Picard and the Adventures of TNG and any of the Star Trek shows great wasn't, like, these grandiose, galaxy-sweeping, you know, achievements. It was, like, moments of, like humanity being basically injected into a scenario that's very, like, either personal or is just a very, you know, small kind of microcosm of something greater that we can understand and apply it to. It wasn't like every single episode, like, Picard stopped, like, a civil war that was representative of, like, a human conflict.
Think about the episode First Contact.
Yeah.
You know, it's about Picard trying to recover his first officer while also guiding a species that may not quite be ready for first contact with alien life at this point.
Yeah.
It's not about the destruction of the universe, and I think the story that they're telling First Contact was incredibly compelling there.
That's one of my favorite episodes, yeah.
I just wonder if it's insecure writing on the part of the writers, if they think that, well, audiences won't be invested unless we tell them that the entire universe is going to be destroyed. You know, I'm just like, no, just...
Do you think there's a nervousness? Because I do think they want people who aren't, you know, hardcore Star Trek fans to watch these shows.
Yeah.
And do you think there is kind of a nervousness about making Star Trek, you know, making it a little more like Star Wars, where an audience who doesn't watch Star Trek can easily get invested because they know this kind of space opera stuff?
Yeah, I can't disagree with that. But yeah. It also, like, the thing is, like, look at what Star Wars is doing right now.
I know.
I think The Mandalorian is look, I try to judge series based on what they're trying to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think The Mandalorian was very successful in what it set out to accomplish.
Yeah.
I look at what Star Trek Picard is trying to accomplish, and I don't know if it's quite hitting those notes that I think the writers meant it for, you know? I think it's a little bit more convoluted. I know what you're saying earlier with maybe just kind of the energy about this show is just seems a little off to a certain degree.
I just find it very strange that, like, a lot of this episode is about, you know, the Romulans were behind the attack like 14 years ago. It's like, yeah, I think we all figured that out long ago.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, really? This is the revelation? And I also love that they, you know, revealed Commodore O is half Vulcan, half Romulan. And I'm like, okay, well, like, this was something that no one seemed to be able to agree on online. One would think that this would lead to something more interesting than just a tossed off line is like, oh, yeah, she's half Vulcan, half Romulan.
But again, why not just make it very clear from the outset?
Yeah.
What, I mean, would that have really changed anything, or that would have just helped us with our journey with this character, you know? Like,
I think, yeah, because most of the dialogue around this character has been people disagreeing as to what her, you know, background is.
Yeah, but it's also like, I'm thinking about, like, hanging so much on, like, mysteries of a show.
Yeah.
What happens if the answers are A, boring.
Right.
Or B, okay, great, I know the answer. Then you cut all the tension out of it then. If you already know the answer then, and it's a satisfying answer, then what tension is left if you're building so much tension with, you know, this kind of mystery? So
I don't know. And don't you feel like so much more tension in the scenes of the characters? Like, you know, like moments last week between, you know, that scene with Troy talking to Picard after he'd said, you know, insensitive comment to Soji. There's way more tension. And I am like on the edge of my seat watching that dialogue exchange versus like all this kind of labyrinthine Borg cube and Romulan stuff.
What's your real name?
Yeah.
It's like, Ryan. Like, ooh, mystery solved.
And the thing is, like, I like Rizzo. Rizzo is not a character who like drives, you know, the story emotionally. No, like, I'm not emotionally invested in anything that the Romulans are doing. And I think I should be. The way this story is being presented and being dragged out, I feel like I should be, like, really emotionally connected to what's going on. No. It shouldn't kind of be just, like, wallpaper.
All right. So, this one, obviously not your favorite of the season.
No.
I'm giving it, like, pretty high marks so far. I'm grading it on a scale, mm-hmm. you know, with, you know, what I've been liking so far with Picard. I put this top tier Picard so far. I'm hopeful for this finale. Like, I think that there's a lot of potential for a lot of payoff,
mm-hmm.
you know? So
I do hope it's payoff and not, like, set up for season two.
Mm-hmm.
That's my hope. I don't think they'll go that route. That doesn't seem to be something they've done in the Discovery seasons. So that's not something I'm really that concerned about. There was a moment...
They might have, like, a little cliffhanger similar to what they've done with you know, season one of Discovery. You know,
a small green speckle land on Picard's shoulder.
Can't wait. Yeah, we get the return of May.
Oh my God. And she's the new Q. And
yeah, she's in his judge robes.
There was another moment I wanted to talk about in this episode, though, which is Picard giving his inspirational speech to Rios at the end of this episode. And I was sitting there watching it. And I'm just like, it's like Patrick Stewart is a great actor. He can do this stuff. Something's missing. Like there's a magic to those scenes that I just feel like is missing.
I know what you're saying, and it seems as if there's maybe like a certain gravity missing in like, because the build up to most of his big speeches, they're mm-hmm. going on, building tension throughout the episode.
Mm-hmm.
Picard speechifies, and you feel as if you've learned like a lot at the end. I don't know if Picard was telling us anything we didn't already know, where you have to have hope, you have to have optimism. It kind of feels more of like a speech that a coach would give a pitcher that's having a hard time getting some strikes, you know?
Right.
And again, that's why I'm not disagreeing with you with what you're saying about kind of the energy of the show is just a little weird.
Yeah.
You know, in that it's not as gripping as I think the writers think it's supposed to be.
Yeah. It is interesting. And there was another Picard moment, too, I noticed earlier where he was talking to characters and like he was kind of getting snappy with them. And it was very interesting just to see Picard behaving like that, because when I think of Picard, Picard is like a great listener. When you watch all of his past stories, like Picard is a guy who really listens to people and then gives a judgment. Like that's very much his mode. And it was interesting to see him being much like snippier and not really listening to people.
Yeah.
It's interesting to see where Picard is. And I hope that that's intentional to show like a Picard who's a little more frayed and a little more of a loose cannon than writing that's a little off model. That's my hope.
Just one final note for me. Rios never noticed the painting of Jana inside of Picard's office there.
Yeah, that's a good call.
Interesting. Anyway.
Yeah, it's well, maybe that'll be resolved in the finale. Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. We'll, of course, have another video up this week tackling a interesting aspect of this episode. And, of course, you can find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in Vandermeer, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's R-E-P-O-R-T, T as in Threshold, shout out. O-N.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
In my solitude, you haunt me. With revelries of days gone.
Transfer complete.